Now, Egypt just, after Sadat was assassinated and Mubarak took office, Egypt has just kind of been there as the worldwide attention has been more on Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Taliban, and now, you know, all this attention on Egypt. And from your perspective, why should rank and file Americans really keep their attention on what's happening in that set of circumstances?
That's a great question. Let me just back up about 10 years for the setup. In 1973, I was in the 82nd Airborne Division and the scout platoon leader for the lead reconnaissance unit scheduled to deploy to the Mideast. We turned in our cars, made our wills, got our shots, drew our ammunition, and stood on the ramp waiting to go to war as a result of the 73 war. And there is no question in my mind that the Russians would have provided troops on the other side. We came close to a shooting world war between the United States and the Soviet Union in 1973 over the conflict in the Mideast. Now, as a result of that, everybody took a deep breath, backed down, and out of that came the agreements, and many years of hard work came the agreements between Israel and Egypt that in exchange for foreign aid from us that assisted their military and their intelligence and their economic development, that they acted as the two sort of stalwarts for peace in the area, while other people over time really had hotter heads, and we had a considerable fighting in Israel, and we've continued to have terrorist strikes, but Egypt has stood aside from that and has acted as a friend, and in the war on terror has acted as an intelligence partner for the United States. So whatever anyone would think about this particular leadership or regime in Egypt, let me just say that over the last couple of decades, as a guy that stood right on the brink, the last time the world came to the edge of war in the Middle East, that's worked out very much to our advantage. Now, whether we're able to maintain that kind of stability in the Mideast over larger issues while these country-by-country internal issues unwrap, that's the thing we ought to be concerned about, Bill. That's why we all ought to be paying attention to this.
So compare Egypt and those neighbors to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and things that have impacted America, such as 9/11, of which we're approaching that 10th anniversary, and I'm sure there's going to be some sort of scare that something like that might happen in September on the 10th anniversary.
Bill, the subject is very confused because we look at a map, we see borders, we think of people as one group. Every single country has got a different set of issues, a different set of divisions, a different set of loyalties, a different set of tribes, tribal divisions. Today, I'm looking just as we talk. I'm reading here about Bahrain riots in Bahrain. Bahrain has been such a good friend that the headquarters of our 5th Fleet. The part of the active Navy that patrols that part of the world is headquartered in Bahrain. And yet Bahrain's been ruled for many, many years by about 30% of the population, which is Sunni, and 70% is Shiite. And they believe that, they have been held down and held back by the leaders that have been friendly to us. We have a similar situation developing in Yemen, where the president has been very cooperative to us. If Al-Qaeda, recently when the head of the National Counterterrorism Center and the head of the Director of National Intelligence both testified last week on intelligence issues, and both of them said that if there is a major threat to us today, and they both believe there is, that it is most likely to come out of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, and that's located primarily in Yemen, where the president's been very friendly to us, and there's a spillover to what's happened in Algeria and Egypt and so forth. People who feel like they've been held down in Yemen are now in the streets and revolting against their president, who is assisting us in keeping down what is at least as big a problem as Al-Qaeda's stronghold in northern Pakistan. So this is a problem for us throughout the region.
And really, since, if you believe the Bible, Cain and Abel or Ishmael and Isaac, it's continued for thousands of years.
Well, let me put it in a little different context that most of us won't remember off the top of our heads, but if you take a quick scan back in history, you'll see the most destructive war in European history was not the First World War or the Second World War or the Wars of Napoleon. The most destructive war in European history was the Thirty Years' War in the 1600s, waged between Catholics and Protestants. But interestingly enough, it was not waged just between Catholic countries and Protestant countries. Over and over, you had a small principality where there would be a Protestant ruling party and many Catholics who felt they were being oppressed, and they would call on a nearby Catholic country to come to their defense, or the other way around, a Catholic a ruler and ruling party and oppressed Protestants who called on Protestants to come to their defense. And as a result, some astonishing number, like the Black Plague, of Europeans were lost in those conflicts. Now, out of that, some 300, 400 years ago, came the rules that we've lived with until recently that say, look, what happens inside a nation, that's that nation's business, and everybody else stays out. So don't call on us to come help you for a conflict inside your nation. That Treaty of Westphalia stood for 300 years. Today, that kind of play we're seeing throughout the Mideast between Shia and Sunni, between tribes, between inside the royal family and outside the royal family in Saudi Arabia, and where it's going is, frankly, anybody's guess.
So where does that leave American intelligence?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it leads ought to leave American diplomacy treading gently. I personally have not been one that argued that the President and the Secretary of State ought to rush into this and declare their allegiance and talk about whose side they're on and try to overthrow a brutal dictator. I think this is a great time for us to watch carefully, encourage a peaceful a resolution of whatever the conflict is. I mean, at the current moment, I think the whole business in Egypt worked out about as well as we could have asked for the moment. Where it goes from here, we don't know. But this is not a moment to be rushing blindly into saying, oh, well, it's wonderful. Anybody who wants to have elections, we're on their side. You know, if elections solved everything, well, we'd just have elections in the prison in Huntsville and we'd have peace. Well, you know, it's not the way the culture in the prison in Huntsville works. So first, in the area of diplomacy, let's just take a deep breath, have a unified vision of this, a unified response, not a time for any political party to be shooting another political party. The President and the Secretary of State need to guide our response in this. Secondly, in intelligence, this is, you've put your finger on a very critical issue. The Egyptian intelligence and the Egyptian special operations have worked and trained very closely with our people. There are stories in the, if you're reading the right parts of the newspaper, there are stories yesterday and today about new agreements and lines in the new budget on increased assistance with a counterterrorism organization within Yemen, where we're going to be providing additional assistance to them in aviation, additional assistance with ground training. So I expect we will see American intelligence trying to... and by the way, one last point. A very interesting issue American intelligence is tracking right now. When all those prison breaks took place recently, when the guards walked off the job, when the police disappeared from the streets and the prisons were emptied, what happened to the high-value al-Qaeda detainees that we had captured and turned over to Egypt? Where'd they go? So you can bet American intelligence will be watching this from the air, from the ground, engaged as best we can with a whole series of people who will be anxious to remain our friends, and it's going to be a very difficult tight walk as we walk through area by area, country by country, all with different issues, all unified by the fact that people who feel like they've been pushed around for a long time think they don't have to take it anymore.
And particularly with the American military involvement in Afghanistan right now, when you have all these other factors now included with, you made reference, for instance, to the prisons now being emptied.
Sure. You know, the Afghanistan is, which way that's going to break is still up in the air. Right now, of course, we have wintertime, and it's hard for the Taliban to campaign in the wintertime. We'll find out later this spring when they come back, when they come out of their hiding and out of their winter quarters, we'll find out how strong they are. I'm actually pretty encouraged by what's happening there. Politically, hugely difficult situation. It's just a fundamentally corrupt government. And when we've said our strategy is to try to win the people of Afghanistan to the government of Afghanistan, recognizing that that's a corrupt government, I mean, that's a pretty tall order. On the other hand, this administration has continued and intensified a policy of the last administration in the targeting and elimination of really high-value, really exceptionally dangerous al-Qaeda and some Taliban leaders. And we've gotten better and better and better at that. So let me tell you that northern Pakistan is not a place where any bad guys are sleeping two nights in a row in the same house. And that's good news for us. Now, whether we can keep up that pressure long enough to turn the tide, look, no ball club, I don't care if you're the World Series champions, no ball club has an infinite bench of first-rate pitchers. You understand what I'm saying? If you keep working your way down to leadership, eventually they have to field the B team and the C team and the D team. So we're in a foot race. Can we knock off the A team and the B team and the C team quickly enough to change the situation before our political time runs out and we have to come home?
Same thing with Iraq?
Yeah, Iraq, a slightly different situation in that we're already on the way out. Now, we're leaving we got a lot of troops still there, and we're going to have them for a long time. We have a lot of people on the ground acting as trainers. The issue in Iraq is that the brilliant thing that the military leadership there did and that President Bush reinforced was to recognize that our core problem was the safety and security of the people, especially in Baghdad and the major cities. And that as long as we could ensure their security, they'd give us the intelligence that was needed to track down and eliminate the bad guys. And that's what the surge was all about. It was not just about a large number of people to oppose the enemy. It was a large number of people so we could put a platoon on every street and make people begin to feel safer. And then we transitioned to building an Iraq army and police so that they could take our place. And so far, so good. The question is that eventually the day will come when the last Americans leave. And at that time, will the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army, will they be strong enough? Will they be loyal enough to continue to provide that kind of security, which is why the country has made the progress it has? So once again, we're up against a question where nobody knows the answer right now. We just continue playing the game as best we can.
And again, not knowing what's going to be out there, but with Egypt and Yemen, the countries further west than Iraq, does that give the possibility that the U.S. presence in Iraq may not be reduced as quickly because we don't know what's going on further west?
Very hard to make that call. It's an excellent question. Very, very hard to answer that. Also playing in this, Bill, along the same lines, is the whole question of the budget. When you work your way through this budget, everybody realizes that up ahead there is a bridge out. You can't keep doing this. The president's budget of $3.7 trillion borrows about a third of that money. You just can't continue to run the country when 40% of what you're spending your money on every day is borrowed. And about 20% of that $3.7 billion is for the Department of Defense. If we're going to have any savings, we either have to raise taxes an astonishing amount or we have to make pretty big, pretty bold cuts. Any big, bold cuts are going to include the Department of Defense. So running two wars, spending back up in Iraq, trying to field forces to respond to anything in the Middle East, at the same time that we're trying to reduce expenditures and keep taxes down to get our economy rerun, we're in a tough spot. Now I'm not telling you the sky is falling. I don't think the world's going to end tomorrow. I'm just describing that, you know, from time to time, events kind of conspire against you. And we've reached a point where an awful lot of diplomatic, military, informational, intelligence, and economic issues are all kind of conspiring against us at the same time. This will not be an easy passage for the next several years.
It seems like maybe the last time we rolled around that set of circumstances may have been the early 70s with Vietnam.
That's a pretty good comparison in a lot of ways. Many of the issues, of course, are different. What we saw as a huge disadvantage at the time was that we had the monster Soviet Union as our enemy. And we had essentially forgotten about the Europe and the Soviet Union for 10 years while we funded Vietnam. And when we came out of Vietnam, what our military realized to its horror is that the Soviet Union had been continuing development of submarines and missiles and bombers and fighter planes and tanks and anti-tank ammunition and missiles all the time. We've been focused on Vietnam, and we played a decade of catch-up. That's what the whole Reagan revolution in the military was all about, catching up, where we had spent a huge amount of money, but building a military to fight in Vietnam, not a military to deter Soviet adventurism in other parts of the globe. Now, fortunately, we had that money, much of it borrowed. We spent it. We outspent them, and in the process, essentially forced them into bankruptcy. That was the end. That's what happened at the end of the Cold War. They couldn't keep up. So yes, there are many ways in which the era of the 70s are similar. The question is, which of those two are we going to be? The guys that were able to borrow some money and build things up and overpower enemies, or the folks who found themselves at the end of their economic string and had to implode their empire in order to survive? I don't know.
Well, the other question, you made reference to the Soviets as the monsters. Who are today's monsters?
Yeah, that's why I said the situation's different.
But there are monsters out there today.
There is no question that our attention has shifted from what's going on in other parts of the world for reasons that I understand. Unemployment bothers us here. The war has gone on for a long period of time. It doesn't seem to be as immediately threatening. We aren't having the same number of day-to-day casualties that we had 3 or 4 years ago. But I'll tell you, if you talk to any of the military folks coming back, especially from Afghanistan and who are working in that region right now, it's always easy to demonize an enemy if you don't know much about him. But if you sit down and look at what's going on where the Taliban occupies, recently the hanging of a seven-year-old in a public square because his grandfather assisted the Americans in some way when they passed through town. Flogging deaths, stoning deaths, the nighttime murder and disappearance of people. It's not a mystery that every time the Taliban actually comes to power in a region, it doesn't take long for the people to decide they don't like that very much at all. The problem is they don't like foreigners either, and so we've got a tough road to walk. So we're in the middle here in Afghanistan and Pakistan until we can get ourselves disengaged. And by the way, over time, we haven't done ourselves any favors in the way we've treated Pakistan. The honest truth is that as soon as the Cold War was over, we abandoned one of our closest allies. We just did. We walked off and left them. We confiscated their navy, which we had given to them on like a lend-lease program. So, the Pakistanis feel like they have some real reasons to distrust America. It's hard for us to rebuild that trust in time of war.
Well, if you go there and you go west through northern Africa, it kind of seems to me the United States may be stuck in the position where there has to continue being a physical presence and a financial presence in order to keep stability. How oversimplified is that statement?
Well, what's working right now in Afghanistan, it's a very interesting dynamic, and the short answer, Bill, is you put your finger exactly on a major issue and nobody knows the answer. What we have been doing in the military, let's just take that as one example. We've been doing in the military now for 15 years, 20 years, for two Bush administrations, the Clinton administration and the Obama administration. What we've been doing is attempt to substitute technology for people on the ground. Everybody recognizes that if we could have a smaller footprint, it's less offensive to any other people in other countries, even if they're our friends and allies. Fewer sailors at a port call, in Bahrain is probably good news, not bad news. The question is, how much can you substitute individuals, human boots on the ground with technology? What we discovered in the surge is cameras are just not any substitute for a rifle platoon at the end of the street. And so we have a real problem. We're working our way through. We're trying to develop a strategy and a set of operations and tactics and techniques and procedures that deal country by country with this issue of what's the least footprint we can have that both accomplishes our objectives without emboldening the enemy. On the other hand, isn't so big that it infuriates people because they don't want to see how many people there. And this is just this is a constant balance. People, one time I made a trip next to out in California. I sat next to a woman who found out I was in the military, and she sat there a minute, and clearly this had never occurred to her before. She said, well, what do you do when there's no war? Well, the military is pretty engaged. You can bet there's a bunch of people in the Pentagon tonight very engaged, looking at every country in the world, trying to answer this question. What's the most we can leverage with the least investment in country after country after country around the world? It's a tough challenge.
Well, getting to think a little bit about more as you're describing the big picture, it almost seems as if the United States is almost in the position like they were in World War II, maybe World War I, having to try to take care of so many allies.
Well, of course, that has been the problem for, I use this word advisedly, because I understand that that it conjures up really bad images and impressions for many people, but that's always the problem with empire. The question is always, you know, how do you influence, I won't say control and dominate, I mean, we're not bestriding the world like the Romans, but how do you influence a large part of the world to get their interest to align with your interest? And by the way, every time you go to any country and find a group of people that you work with and you encourage them, you bring them to your schools, you encourage them to have your values, you encourage them to set up their political organizations like your political organizations, you encourage them to set up their laws like your laws. Well, those people then rise to prominence, and guess what happens? Somebody is left behind in that country, and they're very unhappy about being left behind, and what they see are the traditional values of the country. And so every place you go to try to do good, you are going to alienate somebody who likes it the way it was. And so you're right. We have a sort of the fundamental challenge that empires, whether they're benign or not, always face. And we're trying to be a force for good in the world as a whole. That's very expensive, very resource intensive, and doesn't always make you as many friends as you'd like.
So going back around full circle to the original question, what should we as everyday Americans be concerned about? It, and the answer may, again, oversimplifying it, is we have an awful lot to be concerned about.
We have an awful lot to be concerned about. This is a very unstable time in the world. So how do we prioritize? How do we prioritize that? My personal belief is that our first priority has got to be to get our internal house in order. We cannot find ourselves in a situation, any family that's spending 40% more than it's making every month is just courting catastrophe. You just can't do that forever. And so we've got to find some economies. And none of them are going to be happy economies because everybody's happy the way it was. Well, of course we're happy. We're living on somebody else's money. But we've got to put our internal financial house in order. I think the president's right that we've got to put our internal educational house in order. Now, how to do that, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything the administration has recommended, but the point here is not a political one. The point is that the future is going to be based on the education of our children, and getting them to pull up their pants, sit down, pay attention, and learn something in class. No small challenge. That's the future. We have a number of challenges we're going to have to figure out internally, and one of them is health care. Whatever you think about the health care bill, it's clear that about 60% of our national budget is involved in Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. And those numbers are going up. So we've got to find some kind of solution for that. Otherwise, whether we've got four carriers in the Mediterranean and the Fifth Fleet, or three carriers in the Mediterranean and the Fifth Fleet, that's going to become a minor issue compared to if these costs continue to spiral out of control. So we have a number of issues that, frankly, I don't think the Republicans or the Democrats or the President or John Boehner, either one, can answer. The American people have to look these issues in the eye and tell our politicians what we want done. And if there's a single major problem, I think, that we face in the world today, that's it. Getting the American people to look the issues in the eye and express an opinion that's strong enough that our politicians know what we want them to do.
I'm going to take, hopefully it's the privilege of going way out in the right field, and if I remember my junior high history in the Monroe Doctrine, where the United States decided to, you know what, with the rest of the world, let's just take care of ourselves. You know, what's the impact if I go off to right field and said, everybody come home, we're going to get our house in order, and then we'll figure out about the rest of you later.
Yeah, that's a good one, and there are a lot of people that argue that. I don't want to be a pedantic history major. I'm not. But the interesting point about the Monroe Doctrine, which is a great comparison. The time is a really interesting one to compare. We didn't say in the Monroe Doctrine we're going to come home. In fact, under the Monroe Doctrine, we took the Philippines. What we said in the Monroe Doctrine was everybody else stay out. So it would be the equivalent of our telling Russia and Gaddafi and others, say, let's not see, I don't want to see you meddling around in Venezuela anymore. I don't want to see the Chinese cutting deals anymore with the people in the Panama Canal. But the larger question is, can we reduce our engagement overseas and bring it on home? And the answer is, to some extent. But again, I think this is more going to be a matter of advances in the technology. I just don't see how we can turn our back on the world and come home, tempting as that may be. If we're going to move out of the current economic doldrums, if we're going to reemploy America and restart our factories and have jobs for our children, we've got to export. That's just a fact of life. And we got to export it to somebody who can buy it and is stable enough to buy it. And if the rest of the world is in turmoil, if the rest of the world is on fire, if the rest of the world is broke, then they can't buy our stuff. You know, most of the oil out of the Middle East doesn't come to the United States. Many people are shocked to discover that, because they always say, well, oil stability, and we get our oil, much of it comes from Nigeria, some of it still from Venezuela. We pump some of it ourselves. The oil in the Middle East largely goes Europe, Japan, China. Why do we want that to remain stable and flowing? Why do we want Japan to have oil? Well, the last time they were cut off from oil, they mounted an attack on Pearl Harbor. I mean, they're not going to starve. We need the rest of the world to be prosperous, too, if we're going to sell them our stuff. So I'm very tempted by the idea of, can you know, I've got a son and two nephews in the service, and son's getting ready to go back overseas for his eighth trip. I'd be very happy to have him spend more time here in the U.S. and less time deployed. But I just don't think we can turn our back on the world. Once again, it's a question of walking this fine line. How do we play our hand so that we encourage good and advance our interest while discouraging bad and protecting ourselves with the least amount of resources? Boy, that's a tough job.
Those who don't seem to be concerned about anything in the U.S. except their own survival, you know, is there anything else that those type of folks need to be aware of?
Bill, let me point out one thing that I think just blows by many, many people, that I think is the most critical of all the issues. Of all of the issues. And that is that when you and I stand and look at the map, and we stand with our sixth grader and look at the map, we look at these squares and we say, yeah, it's, you know, there's a pink one, there's a yellow one, there's a green one, that's France, that's India. The fact is that many of what we're looking at in the world that we call countries today, many of those are criminal enterprises. I am extremely concerned about the rise of organized crime worldwide, the astonishing influence of computer theft, child pornography, and the shipping of human beings for sexual slavery around the world, and the money that comes from smuggling, and especially the drug money and the resulting violence. I'm actually as concerned, or more concerned, about that personally. I am as a strategist than I am watching what's happening unfold in the Middle East. If things came apart in the Middle East, you know, except for the issue of war with Israel, other things pretty much we could adjust to by paying more money. We can't adjust to this issue of the criminalization of politics worldwide just by paying more money. It is going to influence. It's already influencing us here in the U.S. That's an issue I'd keep my eye on, the growth of criminality, organized crime around the world.
I've barely begun to touch the surface, but from an introductory standpoint, have I missed anything?
No, Bill, I think that pretty well touches everything. That ought to give everybody plenty to worry about, don't you think?
There's a minority of people who are gonna watch the political shows. There's a minority of people who watch or listen to news or read a newspaper or even care about world events. Without causing any undue scares, is there another 9/11 coming or something else that really is going to be tremendously harmful to the United States?
So. Yeah, the big thing I wish we could do, Bill, I hope what we've done together in the last 30 minutes is we just want to engage people on a daily basis and tell them, you know what, I expect you to be focused on the football game, the baseball game with your kids and your grandkids. I expect you to be focused on school and work and vacation. That's what the life is supposed to be like in America. I'm just suggesting keep your eye on what's going on so that you can give guidance to your elected officials as well, because if they don't have any guidance, they sort of think it up on their own, and we cannot afford that in this world today. People need to be engaged, committed, understand what the decisions the United States is making, and have an influence on those, because they're going to impact every one of us.
And I don't know how right or wrong I am, but it seems like maybe we're in the first or second generation of people with children, especially maybe even teenagers, who I remember as a teen we talked about world events and its impact, and sometimes the discussions got ugly with their parents. But I don't see that kind of dialogue as I'm sitting in the bleachers at a ball game or surrounded by folks at a restaurant.
Well, I suspect that we will see more of it as it becomes more and more clear. You know, when gasoline this summer begins to move to $4 and $5 a gallon, next year there's already very interesting indications on the street that the price of cotton's up 30%. Many of the riots in the Middle East have been the trigger point for the big events. Even in Egypt, the trigger point has been the rise in the staples and food, the cost of what poor people have to pay every day. That's heading up through the roof, 10, 15, 20%. So I suspect there'll be plenty for us to talk about in the bleachers here in the very near future.